So the windmill at Forbourne stands on an outlier of the Gogmagog Hills, 4 miles east of the city of Cambridge. Low chalk hills run to the south of it. Northwards, the windmill overlooks the Fens, which are at most only a couple of metres above sea level. The cap of the windmill rises to just under 50 metres of Forbourne windmill above sea level. And from it, there's an uninterrupted view of the roofs and towers of Ely Cathedral. Forbourne windmill has long been an outstanding landmark in the South Cambridgeshire countryside. And Ian Harrison is at the wheel of a project to restore the mill. And he joins us this morning. Good morning to you, Ian. We'll get the microphone just a little bit closer to you there. We'll pull that one in, so that's it, so we can hear you.
Okay.
I should have asked you to do that earlier on, but nice to see you today. Thank you very much for coming by. We've managed to arrange the interview, and it was on the back of the fact that you had an open weekend. I think it was a National Mills Open weekend at Forbourne Windmill was open as part of that a couple
of months
ago.
That's right. National Mills Day, it's second week in May every year. And a lot of the windmills around the country are open that day to visitors. If I can just say, Phil, you've obviously been reading our brochure and congratulations on mugging up like that, but I don't think it's quite 50 metres high. I think that would be rather a high mill.
Okay.
I think we're only about 50 feet high, but still in Imperial, I'm afraid, being an old mill.
Yeah, so I was probably adding for the rise of the mill itself stands about 50 feet.
Correct,
but
yeah.
Then if you add the elevation of the hill,
that's right,
where it came from. So old money, something like 180 feet or something,
something like that.
But so that would be adding the two together. So when you think about it, if you were standing on the hill, let alone actually up onto the mill and going up a couple of floors, we'll talk about what's inside the mill in a little while. I suppose the next thing you'd there'd be nothing higher than if you sort of reached out to the wash in a straight line, if you drew something on a map.
Yes.
There's nothing really in the way, is there?
That's about right. Although, as you mentioned, you can see Ely Cathedral standing on the skyline as you look due north from the mill. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Straight down the drive that leads up to the mill and across the trees, and with the sun shining on it, you can see the Octagon Tower there. And of course, if you're looking in the other direction, you're over to the Gogmagogs, as you mentioned. But yes, it is one of the few high points around, with lovely views over Cambridge as well and the airfield, and just see King's College there in the background.
Sutton's on a hill, I know, sort of out towards Haddenham and that way, but it's not really the rise that you suddenly have with the Gogs, which sort of makes the break point between, say, Forbourne Fens and the Fens, and
yep.
Suddenly we got sort of dry, higher chalklands.
That's right, yes, which is a great site for a windmill, of course.
So it's a great place to put one, isn't it? So the mill itself stopped working when?
1937. It was built in 1808 and had a very sort of successful history during the 1800s, but as steam mills came in towards the end of the century, so the demand for a windmill sort of dropped away. Early 1930s, the mill got hit by lightning twice, split it down the side. The mill struggled on for a few years after that with using a sort of an external drive rather than relying on the wind to drive the stones. But 1936, another storm hit it, blew the fantail off, and I think eventually they gave up the ghost and it stopped producing in 1937.
So when the wind wasn't good, so the sails didn't turn, so you had this little, if you like, power take-off on the side of the mill, this iron or steel wheel that could be connected to a steam engine?
That's right. No, the mill's quite unusual in that when it was originally built, it just had two pairs of millstones. But towards the end of the 19th century, a third pair was added, which could then be attached to this external drive, which, as you describe, has got this big iron wheel outside that sits on the outside of the mill, to which you could attach through a belt. You could attach that to some kind of diesel or steam engine, to drive the mill if there was no wind. But even so, it just proved to be uneconomic, really, in the end.
There's some fine windmills in the area, and I would love to think Forbourne Mill could, I say, catch up with Burwell. I'm sure you've been along to Burwell Museum and seen the fine windmill they've got
there.
Yes. Mainly brick, I think, whereas Forbourne Mill is made of clunch or brick or stone up to a certain height.
Yes, that's right. So Forbourne Mill is what's called a smock mill. Why? Because it actually looks like a miller's smock. But it's an octagonal mill with an octagonal brick base. And then a sort of a wooden, the middle two-thirds, if you like, are a wooden frame with wooden cladding on it. And then sitting on the top is a circular cap to which the sails are actually attached. And the smock mill was really a sort of a second-generation mill after what were originally the post mills, and then the smock mills came along. The thing about smock mills is they were the first time they put the cap on the top. So it's just the cap that rotates rather than the whole mill. And that allowed, by the cap, the roof of the mill rotating, that allows the sails to turn into wind rather than having to turn the whole mill, which is what they used to do with the original post mills.
So the mill can literally turn into the wind. And to do that, then, it's got a bit like a... we think of a helicopter and we see the tail and we see the tail rotor. And I always think of what we're going to describe next, which is the fan tail, which is, it's very clever technology, really, that allows the mill to turn into the wind.
Yeah, you're right. You describe it very well. I mean, the fan tail mechanism is designed to act a bit like a weather vane, if you like. So if depending on which direction the wind is coming, it'll spin the fan tail. And then the fan tail is then connected through a series of sort of relatively straightforward gears to a rack which sits underneath the cap of the mill. And these gears, as the fantail spins, it turns a drive shaft, which in turn turns some gears, which connect to this rack, and then will slowly rotate the cap to keep it pointing into wind. I mean, it's and when it works, it's amazing to see Burwell have it running very nicely. It's a really nice sight. It moves so smoothly and so quietly. You wouldn't believe it, because there's a lot of weight on that cap. We reckon about 18 tons sitting up there.
And we'll explain why that's a little bit of a problem for later on, Ian, that the 18 tons... It's going to need some shifting soon, but we'll come through that towards the end of the interview and show, we can't show, unfortunately, this is radio, but explain to the listeners what one of your next big steps will be, maybe a couple of years from now, but you'll be able to perhaps update us on that. The other form of technology was what was called a post mill. So we can explain the difference. This is a smock mill and the older post mill system.
Yeah, so on a post mill, essentially the whole mill would sit on a single post. And so the mill itself would then rotate into wind. It would also often have a kind of fantail mechanism sitting on the back, but the fantail would not be connected to a series of drives, but very often would need pushing around at the ground level to rotate the mill into wind. The issue, of course, though, with the post mill is that all of the weight is sitting on that single post, and so over time they tend to be more vulnerable, more exposed to deterioration and to weather and so on. As I say, with the new technology that came along with the smock mills, allowed you to take to remove that risk around standing on that single post and give it a more robust foundation with the brick.
I think it's just remarkable, Ian, that you know, late 18th century, early 19th century, and here we were using renewable energy with a self-steering and self-governing. Another thing is, of course, we haven't spoken about the fact the sails would never go too fast. They actually have a speed control on them.
They do. Well, the control of the sails, the speed of the sails, is done by, as people will know, that they have shutters that on each of the sail, which can be angled, closed or open to a degree, which allows you then to control the degree of wind capture, if you like, and that helps manage the speed of the sails. But the other clever bit, to which I think you're referring, is internally there's a series of governors, which, if you think of a steam engine and you see these two balls spinning very fast, we have that same mechanism inside the mill. And as the faster those balls spin, so they through a series of levers and connections, as the balls spin faster, so they can rise or increase or lower the gap between the millstones as they're spinning. And this controls the quality, or maintains a consistent quality of flour that comes out. It's very clever, very clever.
Do you have any accounts or records from the old millers up to the 1930s to say, well, you probably know the millers' names, and it might be local farmers, but how much could be produced, you reckon, on a good day with a fair sail and a good wind behind the mill?
Now you're asking difficult questions.
Have you ever worked out how many bad bags of wheat and flour have come off?
Yeah, it would vary. We do have some records, and in particular for the last years of the mill, a guy called Mr. Reed was the final miller, and he's kept a very detailed little notebook, which we still have in the house. And you can see the sad decline then, because during its peak years in the sort of second half of the 1800s, the mill would have been very much focused on grinding all of the wheat from the East Anglian fields. But towards its end, as cheaper corn was coming in and then being ground by the steam mills, so the windmills were then sort of diverting to animal feeds and lower quality grains. And that's what we see in the notebook, is this, by the end, it's just animal feed and a few bushels of oats and so on that are being ground down.
Could it be the fact as well that there was grit? Because you've got these massive millstones and they will shed some grit. And they always say grit's good for our guts, actually. We don't have enough in our digestive systems today. But with the flour, you would have had lots of little tiny pieces of stone, which probably wasn't very good for our gums.
And teeth, indeed.
And teeth.
Probably doesn't meet today's health and safety standards.
And maybe you're people right. were going, you know, this bread's got grit. It's come from... I mean, it's lovely to have it milled, but, you know, locally like
yeah,
that.
But it was a surprisingly high-quality flour that would come off these stones, actually. And again, it depends on the types of stones. We actually have two types of stone in the mill. One, millstone grit, hence its name, it's got obvious links, which comes from Derbyshire. And that's the sort of the gritty stone that a lot of people recognise. But the other type of stone, it comes from northern France. It's what's called a burr stone. And that's less gritty and tends to produce sort of less grit into the flour. More expensive. And somebody was telling me the other day that apparently all the burr stone quarries in northern France have all been quarried out now, and it's almost impossible to get hold of this stone now. Although plenty of millstone grit, of course, from Derbyshire.
And every now and again, the miller would have to arrange for a team of people to come in because the stones would wear out. You had to reface them.
That's right. And can you imagine? I mean, I don't know if anybody's seen these millstones. They're huge. I mean, they weigh over a ton each. And there's a mechanism in the mill for actually lifting up the stones so that you can access the face of the stone to what's called redress it. And what would happen? There are two stones. There's a base stone, which tends to stay still, the bedstone, and then the top stone, the runner stone, is the one that rotates. And the stones have cut into them a series of grooves. And those grooves, as they're rotating, act like scissors. So it's like many pairs of scissors cutting the
shearing the wheat off, I suppose, into
exactly, just cutting those grains down and down into smaller pieces. But over time, and typically I think it's about every 500 hours or so running time, these grooves would get worn down, all the grit turning up in the flour, as you mentioned.
That's where it would go.
And so the grooves need to be recut, and we have this sort of special hoist, if you like, for lifting up the stones, and then special tools for recutting the grooves, and there's also in the mill a piece of what looks like railway line, old railway line, which is a very, very heavy piece of cast iron that is a level to ensure that you keep the face of the millstone dead level when you're redressing it.
Learn more every day about windmills. That's why you're here. So the future of the mill. Now, we know that structurally it's fairly sound. It's a fairly general question, that, really, for you.
So there's, A little bit of background, if I may, because we spent the last 3 or 4 years rebuilding the sails and the fantail. So we've done that from scratch, pretty much, certainly on the sails. And so we're very confident. The objective was, when we started that project, was to allow the sails to turn freely and for the cap to rotate into wind. So we did all the work, got the sails up, replaced the fantail, took the brake off, if you like, and the cap, unfortunately, wouldn't rotate. And it was really through trying to investigate the cause of why that cap wouldn't rotate that we first discovered that the curb that the cap sits on, which the cap freely rotates, it just sits on a ring, a ring of wood.
And those 18 tons just keep it
that's
there.
That's right. It's just balanced there.
Yeah.
We discovered that this ring that it sits on, which is supposed to be round and level, was neither round nor level. And then digging into why, then what we've unearthed is, in fact, the structure is slightly weaker than we anticipated. I think the issue is that during the After 1937, when the mill stopped working, the mill was left to deteriorate in the open weather, in the bad weather, and the sails stayed in one place, and that caused all that weight from the sails and from the cap caused one corner of the mill to sag, and that in itself caused a bit of this distortion on the curb. And in addition, as we've now added more weight with the new sails and so on, it's compounded a problem that was already there, which is added to this distortion, if you like, of this curb. And the only way we're going to be able to remedy this distortion is essentially to reinforce or replace the main corner posts. There are eight corner posts running down each of the eight sides that hold up the main weight of the mill. Those posts are going to need replacing, either replacing or reinforcing or having new pieces cut into them. With that stable platform in place, then we can think about rebuilding a round and level curb on which the cap can then rotate. So at the moment, what we're looking at is, because if this could be a potentially very expensive project, so we're trying to figure out ways of doing it in a practical and manageable way. And one of our volunteers came up with a super idea of basically putting a steel box frame inside the mill, four vertical girders, which we can put up inside the mill without disturbing too much of the existing equipment and so on. And we can then use those four girders to take the weight of the cap. So it takes the weight of the cap off the eight corner posts. And that gives us time then, as we get money, resources, labour, whatever, it gives us the time to work on re-strengthening the mill, sorting out the curb and sorting out some of the other problems in there without having any fear that that cap is, and the weight of that cap is causing any further distortion.
You live on site, we can say that, Ian, in a mill house on atop of the hill. Are you going to need to, though, get a big crane in to do this? And if you can, well, can you?
Well, we've had the big crane in three times already when we were rebuilding the sails. Yes, it's quite a sight. I mean, these crane operators are unbelievable. Yeah. They really are. It's like driving an oversized Tonka toy, you know.
Even getting up your driveway, must be.
Turning into the gate was unbelievable. But this huge crane and these multiple steering axles and so on, and you managed to get in there, just squeeze in through the gate. And it was quite a sight. You see this huge boom extending way above the mill as they lifted the main spar of the old sails out and drop the new ones in.
It looks magnificent, I have to say, with the new spars on there. I came along and you've got bunting all the way around all the four sails, and I was thinking, how on earth did somebody clamber up there? I had not realised that you've managed to make the sails turn, which was...
We have the sails turning quite regularly now.
Fantastic.
So I think it was, September 2016, we actually took the brake off and had the sails turning freely in the wind, I think properly and freely, first time since 1937.
I wish I had known about that. I'd love to have come along and seen
it. It's a magnificent sight. And there's a little video of it, actually, which you can see on the website or on our Facebook page. I'm not sure which one it's on.
Yeah, we need to mention that, really, because you've got a Facebook page. It's Forbourne Windmill, if you want to go and have a look there at some of the stills and some of the videos as well. And as Ian has mentioned, there's various bits online, including the website, Forbourne Windmill. .org.uk. It is all one word for 411windmill.org.uk. We could talk for so long, Ian. It's been fascinating talking to you, but one final appeal. You were recently, it was a Forbourne feast day, I think, in the village of Forbourne. You had a nice little gazebo going there. You were looking to recruit people. Whatever your skills might be, just want to slap a pot of paint on some of the brick sides of the mill, or if you're a good craft joiner, carpenter, whatever. Doesn't matter, really. If you want to go in and muck in with this community project, you're still, of course, looking for volunteers.
Absolutely, yes. Any skills, any enthusiastic, willing and helpers will be very, very welcome to come along. The one thing we are particularly looking for, though, at the moment is some help with fundraising. As with many community projects, everybody needs money. But it is funding that is proving to be our main stumbling block. So if anybody out there has got an interest in old windmills, and has some time and enthusiasm and wants to help us look around for some grant funding, that would be great.
But we have to say the millwrights have been really, really helpful, and without their efforts you wouldn't be where you are now.
Oh, absolutely. We've been so fortunate that we've had a millwright guy called Paul Kemp, who's actually based down in Essex. He's given us so much time and we've benefited so much from his expertise on the mill. And he's given a lot of free time to us as well. I mean, I think he's adopted Fulbourne as his pet project, which is great.
Are you having any more open days this year?
Indeed. First Saturday of every month, so the next one is on the 7th of July. But yes, we do try and keep have the mill open, as I say, first Saturday of every month. Perhaps not in sort of January, February, when the weather's so miserable and cold, but for the rest of the year, yes. So again, anybody's welcome to come along on those days. And if there are any groups out there that would like to come and see the mill outside of those Saturdays, just drop us an email through the Facebook or the website, and we're happy to accommodate visits outside of those normal days, but just with a bit of prior notice.
Very generous, Ian. So you can't really miss it. Don't even really need to give you directions. You're heading out towards Fulbourne from Cherry Hinton along Fulbourne Road. By the time you get past Capital Park and Fulbourne Hospital, you'll see it right in front of you. Pretty much, just aim for the hill.
Indeed.
And the windmill on top of it. It's looking really elegant and fantastic, and let's hope you can get on with that cap work. When you do, Ian, do get in touch. Come back and give us a report on what's going on.
Very happy to do so.
You and your team. Thank you very much. It's Ian Harrison, who's heading up the project with Fulbourne Windmill Society to restore the old mill there. Thanks, Ian.